our report card on Latino representation on TV and in education. This week on Latino USA.
Saturday evenings at 8 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Let's start the program today with some politics. Winners in Tuesday's primary elections are looking forward to the vote in the fall. The losers are taking stock. Six states went to the polls yesterday: Kentucky, Georgia, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Idaho, and Arkansas. We wanted to hear more about the results of these elections and what they may say about the mood of the country. So we've called upon NPR politics editor Charles Mattesian, and he is with us now. Welcome. Thanks
Hi,
for
Michelle.
Coming up. Thanks for taking the long trip upstairs. So there's an old saying that all politics is local, but in recent years there have been these wave elections. I mean, the Democratic rise in 2006, 2008, and then the Tea Party movement in 2010. So was there an overarching theme in these results?
I think if there was a singular takeaway, it's that the Republican establishment or traditional conservatives or however you describe them, they're finally fighting back against the Tea Party and they're winning. That was clear from the results last night, I think. And I think that's a theme that has really infused the primary season so far. Doesn't mean that the Tea Party is dead or that it's not having an impact, just that the establishment now controls the commanding heights.
And one good example of that is Kentucky. Early in the campaign, it looked like the incumbent Senator Mitch McConnell, who happens to be the Republican minority leader, was in trouble, but he actually won by a sizable margin, 60-35, over a Tea Party-backed opponent, Matt Bevin. And this is what Senator McConnell had to say last night.
For 5.5 years, the powers that be in Washington have treated the people of this state with contempt. And tonight, I have a simple message for all of them. Those days are numbered.
What's he talking about there, actually, since he was there for 5.5 years, too? I mean, so I guess is he trying to sort of pivot to making himself more of an outsider? Is that it?
Yeah, I think it's a little confusing when you're the most powerful Republican in Washington to be framing about the fact that Washington is trampling on your state. But I think what he's trying to get at is the idea that outsiders are controlling the destiny of Kentucky, which has always been sort of a very fertile subject for politicians to mine. And I think he's also playing on anti-Washington sentiment. Kentucky is a very red state that where President Obama is very unpopular. Harry Reid is very unpopular. And I think that part of the strategy in Kentucky is to tie his November opponent, Alison Lundergan Grimes, to the administration. And that is, you know, one example of it in that speech.
Well, let's hear a little bit about his Democratic opponent, Alison Lundergan Grimes, a little bit of her victory speech now.
This woman, well, she's not an empty dress. She's not a cheerleader. She's not a rubber stamp. She's an independent Kentucky woman that stands on her own 2 feet and thinks with her own head.
How serious a shot does she have?
I think a very, very serious shot.
How come?
Polling shows already that this is a very competitive race, and it's also worth remembering that while McConnell is a big dog in Washington, he isn't exactly wildly popular in his home state. If you look at his approval ratings, they're really rather low for somebody of his stature, for somebody who's been around for 5 terms. And she's a great character to run against him, in part because she's very good at the basics of retail politics. Her family's well-known in Kentucky politics. She begins with name recognition because she's won statewide, and also, just as important, she's going to be very well funded because of all the national Democratic money that's going to pour into that race in November. And in fact, some people are already predicting that's going to be $100 million plus race in November.
Does that outside money, though, how does that play? I mean, sometimes in-state people resent it when they think that outsiders are trying to control affairs in their state. But it sounds to me like you're saying both sides are going to be expecting a lot of outside money.
Right. And that's a fantastic point because McConnell also addressed that very subject last night in his speech at the Victory Party, where he talked about all the Hollywood liberal entertainment money that's going into her campaign. So he sees it right now as an area for him to mine in the fall.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the results of Tuesday's primary elections with NPR politics editor Charles Mattesian. So let's go to Georgia now. We're seeing a potential second-generation Senate family in candidate Michelle Nunn. Her father, Sam Nunn, left the Senate in 1997. But besides that well-known name, what else does she bring to the table?
Well, I think as you mentioned, that's a golden name in Georgia politics, and that's a state that's been very tough for Democrats to compete in statewide in recent years. It's a fairly solidly Republican state, although there is room for improvement for Democrats, and I think Democrats see that as a prospective win largely because of the strength of Michelle Nunn, and that's why Republicans were so nervous about who they were going to nominate in this Republican primary.
Well, were they nervous? I mean, it was a pretty hard-fought primary, was it not? I mean, how many candidates did they have? Like five? And that doesn't seem like a recipe for coalescing, you know, behind one idea. How did that turn out?
Well, in some ways, what Republicans were worried about was that it was a recipe for disaster, because you had five candidates who had different regional bases. But what Republicans had real anxiety about was this is a seat that Republicans probably will and should take in November. But with the wrong nominee against a pretty good, top-notch Democratic nominee, that would be under question. And there were a couple of congressmen in that race who were sort of lightning rods and were thought to be maybe a little bit too conservative for the state. And those congressmen ended up losing, and Republicans ended up getting a couple of candidates in the runoff who are probably much better suited for a statewide race.
So let's go. So we've been talking about red states so far. And obviously, one of the subtexts here is that Republicans would very much like to take back control, you know, of the Senate. And then to do that, don't they have to take over? They don't just have to maintain the states that they already own or run, but they need to take over some blue states as well. So why don't we go to Oregon? And Republicans feel they have an opportunity there. Why don't you tell us about their candidate, Monica Wiebe?
Well, you may have heard a lot about her in recent weeks. She's this really compelling character, where she's a pediatric neurosurgeon that hasn't run before. But what's most interesting about her is she's become one of the most talked about Republican candidates of the cycle, in part because she's captured the national Republican establishment imagination. I mean, as everybody knows, that's a party that has a real problem with women voters, has a problem with electing enough women politicians. And so she, in many ways, addresses many of that party's needs. She also ran an ad that really caught fire. I think people really noticed it was a very powerful, emotional ad about her work as a surgeon, and that really got her on the national radar. And the thinking is that in a state like Oregon, which is, you know, fairly solidly Democratic, it's, you know, a well-known blue state against an incumbent who's not all that weak and hasn't showed that much vulnerability, you need a candidate, a non-traditional Republican candidate, maybe like Monica Wiebe, and I think that's why people are talking about her today.
What's her hook? I mean, what's her main her main idea or platform? Is it opposition to, as a doctor, opposition to the Affordable Care Act, or what is it?
Well, that's in some question. Some Republicans believe she wasn't conservative enough, that she wasn't strongly pro-life, that she wasn't strongly enough anti-Obamacare, that she was, you know, just not conservative enough to be the nominee. But then again, there's lots of Republican political professionals in particular who think that's what makes her so good for a state like Oregon.
There's always this question with a woman candidate, whether how she is treated by both the local media and the national media, and whether she's evaluated in the same way that a man would be. But, you know, even having said all that, she did have a little flare-up of scandal trouble at the close of the primary race. Can you tell us a little bit about it and whether that's going to continue, whether that particular storyline you think will have any resonance come fall?
I think you're right on the money with that observation, because it was in the final week. She was the victim of a May surprise, where this Oppo research was dumped on her on Friday before, on the eve of the primary, about a relationship that had gone sour and you know, a police report that had been filed about her breaking into a former boyfriend's home. To see something like that get dropped in the final days of a primary tells you that a couple of things, including the fact that someone is scared that this person could win. And it was it's pretty harsh, and I think it's occasioned a lot of conversations about the propriety of running those stories and whether it was fair to her. And obviously, Oregon voters weren't that bothered by it.
At least Republican voters weren't that bothered by it.
Exactly, Republican voters, I should say.
And so finally, let's go to Pennsylvania for the final couple of minutes today. Republican Governor Tom Corbett is seen as vulnerable. What can you tell us about Tom Wolf, the Democrat who's going to be facing him in November? And is there any larger story there? Pennsylvania is such an interesting, you know, state. Big state. A lot of people who are, you know what I mean? So the power goes back and forth between Republican and Democrat. So tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, that's a state where, you know, as you say, you've got a couple of big Democratic cities on either end of the state. And in the middle is, you know, very rural and small town oriented. And, you know, as everybody knows who follows politics, it was once famously described as sort of Alabama with Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania and Philadelphia on the two ends. And so Tom Wolf is essentially a candidate who came out of nowhere. He's a very wealthy businessman, not from one of the city's power centers, from York County, which is sort of south central part of the state. And what's really interesting about him is he was not somebody who was on the political radar, yet he came in, knocked off the Republican congresswoman or the Democratic congresswoman who was the front runner at the time, and won, you know, pretty handily. And when you look at the results, it's pretty amazing the way he ran. He ran very strong in for a candidate of his background in the urban areas, but also in the suburban areas, and also I think in the outstate trade areas, that some of the rural counties too, and I think he could be a very troublesome competitor for Tom Corbett in the fall.
Well, I know you had a late night, so thank you for coming up today. Is there anything that kind of captured your attention over the course of this meeting? You obviously have to keep your eyes on a lot of different races, and obviously one of the themes that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation is how kind of the establishment Republicans, who may have been kind of caught a little bit out of sorts in 2010, really seem to figure out how to address the Tea Party challengers and overall seem to do very well, you know, against them. Is there anything else that kind of captured your attention this year that you want us to keep an eye on as the general election approaches?
I'd say there are probably two observations I've made and out of all the primaries so far, and particularly last night. The first is the one that you spoke to, which is the idea that the Republican establishment is fighting back and winning finally. This wasn't the case in recent election cycles. The other point that I think has been largely overlooked is that, okay, so we see all this polling data out there talking about toxic levels of anti-incumbent sentiment. Well, the dirty little secret is nobody's lost yet. No incumbents have been downed. Most of them are going uncontested in the primaries or winning by huge landslide numbers. Very few of them are getting tough races in the primaries. So if that toxin is in the political bloodstream, you know, we're not really seeing much evidence of it yet. That might come in November, but in the party primaries so far, we're not seeing it.
Charles Mattesian is NPR politics editor. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Took the long trip upstairs. Thank you for that. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. I enjoyed it.
Coming up, as India swears in a controversial new leader, some Indian Americans say it's a wake-up call to get more involved in politics.
I think that second and third generations of Indian American immigrants in this country have really come of age, and we are now more attuned to issues of racial, social, and economic justice.
We'll talk about India's elections, its future, and what that all means for Indians here in the U.S. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Koch brothers became America's most powerful and private dynasty. We talk with Daniel Shulman, author of a new biography of the Koch family. We'll discuss how they created the second largest privately held company in America and the roles family members played in the John Birch Society, the Libertarian Party, and the Tea Party. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We want to spend some time on international affairs. Now, in a few minutes, we'll talk about India's elections, but we start in Nigeria. That's where the abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls a month ago has brought new global attention to the country's ongoing struggle against the extremist group Boko Haram and the violence that group has inflicted on the country. Yesterday, the central city of Jos suffered yet another blow after two bombs ripped through a busy area. That was followed by a suicide blast in a street full of bars and restaurants in the northern city of Kano. Here to give us the latest on the situation, as well as the ongoing story of the kidnapped girls, is freelance journalist Chika Odua. She's been keeping us updated since the girls first went missing a month ago. We reached her in Abuja. Chika, welcome back. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
What do we know about these blasts? And is it pretty clear that this is the work of Boko Haram?
You know, I would say this is a very clear attack. being inflicted by Boko Haram. I just spoke to someone now who actually lives in the city of Jos. She's been there for many years. And what she was telling me was that what happened was around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, a car was parked at a fast food restaurant. There were some traders close by, and they told this car to move away from the restaurant, that there's not enough parking space. The car then moved away to another very busy part of town. This is a market, and that's when the bomb blast went off. So the aim of this car was definitely to find a very busy area in Jos. Jos is a very huge city. It's heavily, heavily populated. And for what we know now is that about 180 to 200 people are now dead because of these two blasts that went off, two car bomb blasts that went off yesterday afternoon in Jos.
What has been the governmental response to this so far?
Well, so far we're hearing more of the same. The president says that he's on top of this insurgency, but again, it's more of the same. There have not been any movements as far as military deployed to the area. Nothing has come out of that at this point. We're hearing, again, more of the same from the president, promising to stay on top of it.
Reporters are all saying that this has the hallmarks of an attack by Boko Haram. Why is that?
That's a good question. Jos has been a very violent-prone area. In the past decade or so, violence has taken out there, and it's been with different groups of people. Why I think this is more so the hallmark of Boko Haram is because of the recent attacks, the ones here in Abuja. Those were both car bombs. So I think people are just linking up what's happening in the country. It seems that Boko Haram is trying to spread. So the one in Kano, the one in Abuja, now in Jos. So this is definitely, as far as what we can see, the work of Boko Haram.
So it's been moving to the story that has captured the attention of so many people around the world, the kidnapping of these young women, schoolgirls. West African leaders met in Paris to talk about how to deal with the group, and they are saying that they are going to wage total war against the group. What does that mean, and how are Nigerians responding to that? I mean, given the criticisms of so many people that the Nigerian government has not been effective in dealing with this so far.
Right. The Paris talks, what came out of that was that these heads of state, they agreed that there would be a battalion force stationed in northeastern Nigeria around the Lake Chad region. And this force was made up of troops coming from Chad, Niger, Cameroon, and of course, Nigeria. There was not too much focus on the kidnapping of the girls. Most of the focus was on how to amp up border security so that the militants could not keep crossing international barriers. What Nigerians see is that perhaps this attempt to involve the neighboring nations may actually bring the girls back.
A man claiming to be the leader of this group issued this video, I think a lot of people have seen it by now, offering to trade the girls for his jailed comrades. What are the points of view about this? I mean, do you see kind of public opinion coalescing about a certain point of view?
You know, I think negotiation is such a very risky thing to do. Many Nigerians are torn. Some of them are for it, some are against it. The ones who are for it kind of use examples that were done in Nigeria's history. Most recent, negotiating with terrorists and militants in the Niger Delta. People are saying if that was done in that case, why can't it be applied in this case? Other Nigerians say, no, this group, Boko Haram, has done enough bloodshed that this cannot be negotiated. Others, again, are saying that this needs to be presented in a more humane light. Negotiate with these people. These are human beings. These are, in fact, our sons and our daughters, actually, who are part of Boko Haram. Negotiate with them and try to get them to understand the point of view. Others say, no, we need to take a more militant stance. So there is no consensus in Nigeria as far as the topic, the issue of negotiating with these militants.
What about the idea of asking for sanctions to be imposed on Boko Haram? The government has recently asked the United Nations Security Council to do that. Would that even affect them?
I don't see how sanctions can actually affect them. Yes, Nigeria asked the UN Security Council to impose sanctions on Boko Haram. What does that look like? We don't know exactly how many people are running around in the name of Boko Haram, but our sense is that this is a few hundred to maybe perhaps 1,000 or so. I don't understand actually how sanctions would apply. And again, many Nigerians don't see sanctions as being practical. This seems, again, perhaps another empty attempt by the president to look as if he's doing something. So perhaps this is more for appearance. We're not actually addressing the real issue.
Before we let you go, you recently visited Chibok, which is the town where the girls were taken from. What's the atmosphere there? How are they coping with this?
You know, a lot of people are expecting these people, the people in Chibok, to be crying on the streets, but this is not what's happening. What I felt in Chibok was more so a spirit of unity, a spirit of optimism. Everyone is praying, and they understand, they believe that their God, whether it's the Christian God, whether it's Allah, they're all praying together for the girls to return. So I felt a strong spirit of optimism in Chibok, where people are kind of helping each other to cope quietly and again as a community.
What about the rest of the country?
People here are terrified, and they're confused, and they're frustrated, and they're angry. That's the best way to convey it. Just being on ground here, you're hearing people talk on the street, you're hearing conversations in the marketplace, you're hearing dialogue on local radios, and the overall sentiment is what's happening to our country. Things are falling apart right before their eyes, and there does not seem to be an end.
Chika Odua is a freelance journalist based in Abuja, Nigeria, and she's bringing us up to date on events there. Chika, thank you so much for speaking with us once again.
Thank you.
From Africa's most populous country, we want to turn now to the world's largest democracy. India is preparing to swear in a new prime minister next week, the controversial Narendra Modi, who led the country's conservative opposition party. His overwhelming victory ends more than 60 years of control by the Indian National Congress. That's the party that's been led by the Gandhi family for decades. Commentators say this win could profoundly change the course of India's future. We wanted to find out more, so we've called the LA Times South Asia correspondent Shashank Bengali. Shashank, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We were also interested in what the Indian American diaspora is saying about all this. So we've called Deepa Iyer. She's the former director of South Asian Americans Leading Together. She's now working on a book about America's changing racial landscape. Welcome back to you as well. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So Shashank, let me start with you. Tell us some of the reasons this victory is considered so significant.
Well, it's the first time in 30 years, Michelle, that any single party in India has captured a majority of seats in parliament. Hasn't happened since 1984. And in India's sort of fractious system, most governments are led by kind of shaky coalitions. So the size of a victory by the opposition party led by Narendra Modi was really significant. It eclipsed what even the kind of most optimistic predictions were before the election. And it really shows just how overwhelming the demand was from a large segment of the voters here for real change and for real economic dynamism, which India is seen to have lacked in the last several years with rising inflation, a lot of corruption scandals that have come to light. Modi campaigned for change, and voters seem to embrace that message very profoundly.
He seems to have done particularly well among younger voters. Is that correct?
That's right. Voters younger than 35 really flocked to him. He ran a really slick campaign, almost Western style. There were a number of campaign events where he appeared via hologram. There was a very sophisticated social media effort by his aides to really find people, not just young people, but really around the country, reach out to Indians on Facebook, Twitter, text messages, WhatsApp, all kinds of different things that Indians use to communicate. The Modi campaign was really very good at leveraging those platforms. And beyond that, really the message of change and vigor, even though Modi is 63 years old and he's been a governor of a Western state for about 12 years, he really resonated with the youth. You know, just the sort of vigor and optimism he projected were really very powerful themes of his campaign.
Well, I want to talk more about that with Deepa, and in fact, because you wrote a piece about this. You know, there's another side of Mr. Modi that you wrote about that a lot of people are concerned about. In 2002, anti-Muslim violence killed nearly 2,000 people in the province where he was the chief minister, and he was accused of instigating and organizing the rioters. And that's why many people might remember that he was actually denied a visa to the U.S. a few years later. And so I'd like to ask, first of all, you wrote a piece about this. Are there concerns about his particular brand of nationalism and what that might say about his commitment to the pluralism that mm-hmm. is a fact in India?
That's right. Well, I think Indian Americans like myself are having robust discussions within our families and online about the impact of the elections. And one of the strands that's emerging, Michelle, with progressive Indian Americans is how will this new government address issues of social and economic justice? So how will the rights of women, LGBT communities, immigrant workers, faith minorities be addressed? And I think there are two reasons for that. One is what you just alluded to, that there's a history here with the 2002 riots, and Mr. Modi was roundly criticized by human rights groups about his leadership or lack thereof. And then secondly, I think that second and third generations of Indian American immigrants in this country have really come of age, and we are now more attuned to issues of racial, social, and economic justice given our own positioning as people of color in the post 9/11 environment.
Speaking specifically about hate crimes that were directed against many people of South Asian descent because they were believed to be Muslims. I mean, not that anyone's condoning it if they had been Muslims, but in part that there were a number of cases of people who were attacked based on, you know, appearance, which right. you mentioned in your piece, you called it the Indian elections, a wake-up call for Indian Americans. What do you mean by that? I'm particularly interested in also the question of whether Indian Americans have traditionally been that involved in right. the politics of India.
Well, I think traditionally what we've seen is that the first generation of Indian immigrants in this country have obviously been interested in foreign policy, India-U.S. relations and the like. But with second and third generations, people born and brought up here, people like myself, are really looking to how issues affecting marginalized communities will be addressed. And I definitely think that's because of some of our own experiences in the post 9/11 environment where Sikhs, Muslims and people who look South Asian have been targeted by surveillance, racial profiling, and hate violence. And so that lens, I think, influences the way that we're looking at these issues both here and in our country of origin.
Shashank, do I have this right that this was the first time that non-resident Indians were allowed to vote?
That's right. And a number of them did. And we don't know the exact numbers because the final numbers have not been put out by the election authorities. But there really was a lot of interest that I could sense from the U.S. in this race. I mean, Modi is a very outsized figure, and a large part of the Indian diaspora, Deepa, correct me if I'm wrong, in the U.S. is from Gujarat, which is the state that Modi has led since 2001. So a lot of people, as that state has progressed economically, in part due to Modi leadership, there's been a lot of probably a lot more travel back and forth between U.S. and Gujarat, as you say, you know, family members come to check on relatives, and also some, in some cases, to move back to Gujarat as the situation there has improved. So there have been linkages, and Modi is really quite well known among Indians in the U.S. So it may be a case of his personality also kind of influencing people to get involved in the U.S., you know, whether they like him or they distrust him.
Can I ask, what about the other way? Was he interested? Did you get any sense that he was interested in what the diaspora thinks of him?
Well, it's interesting. You know, part of his appeal, especially to young voters who are of a different ilk than the parents' generation and those before them, you know, Modi was really very much campaigning about India. He ran a campaign about his record, and he ran a campaign about what he wanted to do. He was very careful not to talk too much about other countries. He barely even talked about Pakistan, which, of course, is India's kind of blood rival. And I think that is part of his appeal to young voters who are sort of sick of India playing second fiddle to these other countries. They very much want to compete with the U.S. and achieve some of the same middle-class comforts as we in the U.S. have. But his message is very much about what he can do for India based on his own record.
Deepa, final thought here, that India has a huge diaspora. I mean, not just in the United States, but in the U.K., you know, Australia, you know, throughout the world, really. So it's really hard to kind of say what is the kind of the point of view of the Indian diaspora going to be. But just focusing on the U.S., is public opinion coalescing in a particular posture? Do you have a sense of where the Indian diaspora in the U.S. wants to be relative to Mr. Modi going forward?
I think we'll have to wait and see at some level. I mean, there are nearly 3 million Indians who live in the United States. And, you know, I do think that there's a sense of cautious optimism. I think that the promise of economic growth, no corruption, and other campaign promises, people are looking at that and are hopeful about that. But at the same time, I think that there is some vigilance among Indian Americans and other South Asians about how will this new government, how will Mr. Modi address issues around social and economic justice affecting marginalized communities? And that is going to be, I think, a framing point in terms of the organizing moving forward.
And Shashank, final thought from you. Is there a 100-day plan or a top priority that Mr. Modi must deliver on the promises that he made in the campaign? What's his top priority in your view?
Well, everyone's looking, Michelle, to see what his economic team looks like and who he appoints as finance minister. Jobs are really number one on everyone's list, and it's going to be a long slog. There's some really structural issues in the Indian economy that will make it harder for him to achieve rapid change here in the way he streamlined things in his home state. It's going to be very difficult to run a whole country based on what he did in Gujarat. So people are really watching to see what team he puts together. Right now, he is really focused like a laser on the economy. It's in every speech that he gives, he talks about bringing growth and development for all. And so far, he has given signals that he wants to really make this growth for the whole country, which includes women, which includes minorities. He's trying to move past the divisiveness of his image and really try to build a more inclusive, sense of his own leadership. So we'll see. It's going to be very, very interesting.
Shashank Bengali is the LA Times South Asia correspondent. We reached him in Mumbai. Deepa Iyer is the former director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, a civil rights group. She's now working on a book about America's changing racial landscape, and we're looking forward to that. She joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Coming up, an emotional moment in the television comedy Louie has viewers talking about the way overweight women are treated and how they see themselves.
It sucks to be a fat girl. Can people just let me say it? It sucks. It really sucks.
So is that a brave moment of truth or just another TV cliche? Our roundtable takes on the debate. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young. As Natasha Trethewey ends her tenure as poet laureate, we'll get her thoughts on the form.
Well, isn't it wonderful that poetry gives us a way of saying exactly what we mean and meaning it, and meaning something else at the same time?
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Even after 100 years, the legacy of the First World War lives on in much of Europe.
Some of the problems associated with World War I are still there in the Balkans today.
Touring the sites of World War I in the former Yugoslavia and in Britain. Plus, Jane and Michael Stern share what their favorite road food cooks in the South tell them when they ask for their secret ingredient.
The answer to that is we cook it just right.
It's all on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday at noon on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. So let's finish up the program today talking about something a lot of people have been talking about because of a recent episode of comedian Louis C.K.'s show, Louie. The episode called So Did the Fat Lady took on the issue of weight and appearance and the double standard that I think most people believe does exist between how men and women are viewed. The setup is that Louis, who plays a character very much like himself, a not necessarily movie star handsome comedian who does stand up in clubs, finally agrees to go on a date with a funny, charming waitress who's been asking him out for a while, and he's been rebuffing her because she's heavy, and she finally calls him out. Here's a clip.
On behalf of all the fat girls, I'm making you represent all the guys. Why do you hate us so much? What is it about the basics of human happiness? You know, feeling attractive, feeling loved, having guys chase after us. That's just not in the cards for us. Nope, not for us.
There have been many responses to this episode. Some people have been singing its praises, saying it's tackling a tough but ignored issue for plus-size women. Other people feel it misses the mark. So we wanted to gather a number of points of view about this. With us now, Lisa Lee. She's the co-founder of Thick Dumpling Skin. That's a blog that looks at body image issues and eating disorders in the Asian American community. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Libby Hill is a writer and contributor to the AV Club, where she wrote about this episode. Libby, welcome to you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Michelle.
Cece Olisa blogs at plussizeprincess.com. She also wrote about this episode. Cece, glad to have you with us as well.
Hi, great to be here.
And we hope that Danielle Henderson will be able to join us. She's a pop culture writer for The Guardian and Vulture.com. We're still trying to get connected with her. So let's just start with, you know, I just want to hear what you all have to say about this. We just heard a clip from the episode, and for people who didn't get a chance to watch it, the actress there is Sarah Baker. And I do have to apologize a little in advance for some of the language, because there's some phrases that, you know, some parents would prefer that their kids not use. But the basic premise is that being a fat girl sucks. Okay? So, Cece, why don't you start? What was your reaction to it?
When I first saw it, I was delighted to see it on camera for everyone to see, kind of the inner monologue of a plus-size girl who is dating. I date a lot, and I think that sometimes that's a novel idea for people, but big girls do go on dates and we get courted and things like that. I think the interesting thing to me was that what she was saying was really more about his insecurity than hers. If you watch the full episode, she asks him out, which takes a lot of confidence. But it was his insecurity that kind of made the whole situation awkward, which was kind of fascinating to me.
You said that that's how you felt at first. Did you change your mind?
When I watched it?
Yeah.
At first, I was like, oh, gosh, are we going to go down this rabbit hole again of, like, the big girl who's cute but not cute enough? But when she kind of empowered herself and spoke her mind, I thought that was a great moment for everybody. And I think that's why so many plus-size girls were cheering, because even if we haven't been able to vocalize it, we've been there.
Danielle, I hear that you're with us now. Are you there?
Hello.
Hello. Okay.
Nice to talk to you.
So glad we were able to get connected. What was your reaction?
I kind of railed against the, well, I liked seeing it. I agree with Cece that it was nice to see it on the TV. It was nice to see people talking about this topic. But I really railed against the idea that being fat just sucks automatically. And it sounded to me more like Louis talking through women about himself. And I don't know that those two things are always the same thing, because it's a very gender thing, being overweight. In America.
Well, that was part of the point, right? Which is that, what? Explain what you mean by that for people who don't normally use that kind of phrasing. What do you mean it's a gendered thing, being overweight?
Well, when I wrote about it for Vulture, I had said that the experience of being overweight when you're a man usually equates to the fact that you are allowed to take up space, that you're physically allowed to have some space. But when you're overweight and you're a woman, it rails against femininity in some way. You're an affront to femininity when you're an overweight woman. So the fact that he was saying, oh, being an overweight woman sucks, it didn't really seem to me the narrative of most of my friends who are overweight, or myself who's overweight, immediately go to. There's a lot of working to have some confidence, and a lot of work that you have to take, that it takes to have some confidence around being overweight and being a woman.
Libby Hill, what do you think?
I was absolutely torn by the episode. I was of completely two minds. My first impulse when it started, like Cece, was, oh no, how is this happening? I thought, you don't know me. You don't know what it's like to be me. And no matter how much I respect Louis C.K., like, I just didn't think there was any way he could understand what this point of view was, what it was to be a fat woman, and especially in America. And I balked at it. Honestly. But as I sat with it, and as I watched Sarah Baker's monologue, as I let the episode cogitate a little bit, I realized that this, more than anything, was an opportunity, if only because we're talking about it right now. We are having an open discussion about what it is to be an overweight woman in America, and I don't know that that would have happened without this episode. So I thought that what was really important, what was more important maybe than who was the mouthpiece, i.e. Louis C.K., for this conversation. It was providing an important pedestal for it.
Hmm. Lisa Lee, what about you?
I think what's interesting, and obviously, you know, I'm Asian American, I'm Chinese, and I'm, you know, thinking about this from that lens. And I think what's so interesting is we are oftentimes told how to feel about ourselves through what is going on in media. And that's, I think, is particularly true for people of color. So, and in this particular case, like the others have mentioned, it's, you know, we are being told that being fat is terrible. And that, I think, is dangerous because it teaches people who are overweight to think about themselves in a certain manner. So they might not, I mean, I know a lot of people who are overweight but are very confident, very happy about themselves, they love themselves, but I think society always sort of brings us back to this point of, like, you know, this is how you're supposed to feel about yourself. And I feel like that's, I don't know, I don't feel like that's anything revolutionary or interesting to me.
You know, you were telling us earlier that, you know, culturally you're saying, at least with a lot of the families that you know, weight is something that's not taboo and that people are very, can be very blunt about other people's weight and in fact feel that they're entitled to, particularly within the family, say, you know, commenting on people's weight in a way that perhaps other people would not feel was okay to do it or impolite. Do you feel like there's a lot of pressure on Asian American women to be thin, to be super thin, and if you're not, that you're supposed to be ashamed about that? I mean, I know there's a lot of different feelings about how different ethnic groups sometimes have different feelings about it. What right. do you think,
yeah.
Lisa?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I definitely, I understand, I think, that body image issues is something that a lot of women experience, and a lot of men too. But I definitely feel that the issue affects people of color a little bit differently. And in my specific case, I'm thinking about, you know, East Asians, like Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, Japanese Americans. You know, I think there are two issues. One is just, I think there's the lack of representation and misrepresentation of Asian Americans in media, right? That informs us how we should behave and think about ourselves. And unfortunately, because we are not seeing a lot of ourselves on media, we kind of go to the depicted stereotypes to, again, inform us about how we should think about ourselves and, of course, our bodies. And a lot of the stereotypes out there are that, you know, Asian women are fragile, they're demure, they're wallflowers, they're pushovers. And that's a very real stereotype that I think is then internalized. And I think from, like, the cultural and familial standpoint as well, I think just, you know, throughout history, we've been taught, you know, what is the accepted sort of westernized beauty that we should desire. And I think that goes, you know, even beyond body size. I think that has a lot to do with, like, skin color, yeah, right? The way that we, you know, want our hair to be a certain way. So I think there are issues kind of, you know, internally, you know, within the culture as well as what is projected onto the culture.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a new sitcom coming down the road. And we, that occasion that stars an Asian American family, it's the first time since Margaret Cho's sitcom All American Girl, and she's written subsequently after the show went off the air about how much pressure she was under to stay a certain size and to be thin, and she talked about just how this kind of just messed with her psyche for years, you know, afterward. I think she's been very open, you know, about that. But, you know, Cece, I'm interested because a lot of people have this idea that African Americans are more tolerant of different sizes and body sizes and more accepting and even appreciative of the larger sized woman. But you've been talking, one of the things you wrote about in your piece was how that isn't necessarily so, especially in the dating world. You used the phrase, which I thought was hilarious, called you were in a mixed weight relationship, and that being a bigger bodied person dating somebody who's of smaller frame, how people kind of gave you the message that maybe you shouldn't be with this person, or that you were just so lucky that he dated with you. Do you want to talk about that?
Absolutely. I think that there is kind of a myth that Black women kind of get a pass for being bigger, that Black women are kind of celebrated for having, you know, bigger bone structure and curves and all that. And I think one of the things that people kind of forget is that it's a little bit nuanced, that sometimes it's about being fat, but being fat in the right places. There's a difference between having boobs and a butt and having a gut. You know what I mean? And sometimes I think that goes across all cultures, right? But yeah, I think that even in the Black community, there's definitely a pressure to have a body of a certain type, whatever that may be, whatever that ideal is kind of decided on. And I think even though we can all be plus size and confident and big and still understand that we're beautiful, somehow it always comes back down to dating. Sometimes it's always that warning of like, don't get too big, a man's not going to want you, and things like that. Like,
people say that to you?
Oh my goodness. It's either implicitly or implied. But the message comes across. You know, sometimes, you know, people will come at you with the health thing, of course, but it's oftentimes about being desired and kind of eliminating the idea, like, what if I think I'm pretty? What if I think I'm okay? If a man doesn't think you're okay, then it's a problem and it needs to be addressed right away, which can be really confusing when in every other aspect of your life, you are confident.
Danielle, what do you think about the fact that, I know Libby was saying that, you know, her piece was Fat Women Talking, Louis Starts a Necessary Conversation, but James, how do you feel about the fact that it's, he's an artist. I mean, he's allowed to say what he wants to say and we can react to it however we react to it. But and the actress, you know, Sarah Baker, I don't know if how you feel, but I thought she was delightful. But I mean, she comes across as everything. That was kind of the whole point. She's funny. She's charming. She's fun to be with. But she still feels like he's not appreciating her because she's big. Would it have felt differently if a woman comedian had raised this instead of a man comedian saying this? I mean, I don't know. What do you think about that? Do you care?
I do care. I do. I think that it would be different because I don't know that it would get on air. I think there's also this thing that's happening where we have to acknowledge the idea that, or the fact that, that Louis C.K. is who he is. And he's given a lot of leeway and he's given a lot of forgiveness for a lot of topics that are culturally taboo. And I think that there's kind of this implicit understanding of him as a genius that kind of gives people a little bit more. They approach it differently, I think, than they would if they, Jerry Seinfeld, had approached the subject, or Kevin Hart. So yeah, I think that if it comes through the lens of a female comedian, I do think it would have been a different conversation. I don't think it would have started with, you know, you suck for not recognizing how hard this is for me. I think it's great that he broached that subject. I really do appreciate that he brought it up. But I think that it would have been different because it's experientially different for women.
You were saying what Louis gets right and wrong about weight in women. So tell me so even with the appreciation for, you know, bringing it up and trying to be bold and all that about it, what's he getting wrong?
I think he really just missed the point of taking this previously confident character that he created. I mean, Sarah Baker was phenomenal in this show, and I really loved her. I really loved her in this episode. I think he takes this idea that she could be confident and wonderful in every other aspect of her life, and then using him as this totem for all men. That's where he really lost me. Is where she started saying, where she launched into her monologue, and said, you know, I'm going to use you as a stand-in for all men, as if overweight women just walk around with this cross to bear, looking for someone to unload on all day long. That seemed off to me. It seemed kind of wrong. I understood what he was doing from the point of dramatizing the show, but it just didn't seem fair. It seemed as though it kind of simultaneously wanted to venerate and vilify overweight women.
Does anybody think, I mean, maybe Lisa, this is for you, do you feel that this kind of event changes anything? Do you think it makes people, you know, walk taller or think a little deeper about their own stuff? I mean, I have no idea who, you know, Louis C.K. is dating in real life. You know, I have no idea. You know, I mean, part of his comedy is, you know, he's a divorced dad and he talks a lot about family and trying to stay connected to his kids and kind of his foibles as a parent. But I have no idea who he's dating in real life. I mean, I know that the producer, actor Kelsey Grammer, has said that Hollywood is about the richest guy with the hottest girl. I mean, that's all it's about. So, I don't know, Lisa, you talked a little bit about media, so we have about a minute and a half left. What, do you think something like this changes anything?
Unfortunately, I don't think so. I think my personal feeling is that what we need to see in media to really change the status quo is how do we put content out there that is creative and showcases women just being, right? And I think, you know, we're seeing a little bit of this in the Mindy show, for example, of Mindy just being like, I mean, I know she definitely raises issues around weight and body size as well, but I feel like the majority of the show is just her being awesome and confident and funny. And I feel like that's kind of the content that we should see out there, where it just normalizes women, you know.
Wait, do people want to watch people being awesome, whether they're men or women? Is awesome funny? Or awesome, confident people funny? I mean, was Seinfeld awesome and confident? Was he funny?
I mean,
isn't funny sort of rooted and broken and a little bit, or messed up or something?
Yeah,
no?
I mean, absolutely. Like, I think, you know, we all have our flaws, right? But I think this sort of explicit call out around, you know, body size is just, I don't know, to me, that's not creative. I feel like we need to find a different way of turning the discussion of weight kind of upside down, and kind of get beyond, you know, these sort of like explicit monologues. I don't know. I feel like that's kind of my view. I think it's these are issues that needs to be addressed, but I'm yearning as a viewer
it's
for
tired.
Something different.
Okay. Well, thanks. We have to leave it there for now. We just started it off. So thanks for starting it off with us. Lisa Lee is the co-founder of Thick Dumpling Skin. She joined us from San Francisco, California. Libby Hill is a writer and contributor to the AV Club. She joined us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Cece Olisa blogs at plussizeprincess.com. She joined us from our bureau in New York. And Danielle Henderson is a pop culture writer for The Guardian and Vulture.com. She was with us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Thank you all so much. I need to take 1 minute to say that, as you may have heard, NPR announced Tuesday that production